calves they would keep for replacement bulls. And they didn't sell no heifers, whatever. They kept all the heifers. And at that time, they only had about a 35% calf crop. In other words, they'd have 35 calves out of 100 head of cows. So half of them would be bull calves. So they didn't get to keep too many heifers. And the old cows that would die off, they never sold an old cow, and them old cows would die off, and they had to keep all their heifers. And then they would have quite a time keeping their numbered herd up. And back when I come down here, well, I got talking to them about improving some of this ground, and they made fun of me. Because the only way they knew how to clear the palmettos off was with a grubbing hoe, and you ain't going to get a cowboy to work with a grubbing hoe. So I quit talking about improving the pastures. But after several years, after about 1940, then the University of Florida got to telling them that they should do all this. And some of the county agents in each county over the state would get them to clear up a little piece, and they would dolomite it, put lime and dolomite on it, and got them started that way. And then they had to buy up this land to have any. At that time, the state owned all the land. It didn't cost them nothing to run their cattle on it. But after they bought this land and had to pay taxes on it, it cost them more to run their cattle. They had to improve and try to do better. So that's when things started changing. And I was waiting on Sandlode John's down here. I'm going to get him to give you some information on it, because I think that's off of the Indian reservation. And I think they have done better on commercial cattle. Maybe not in the late years, but they're the ones that started. They had the first purebred herd of cattle in Florida. The rest of them was all crossbreds and come from them DeSoto cattle or Ponce de Leon cattle. But the government sent a train load or two of purebred. They weren't registered, but they were purebred white-faced cattle down here for the Indians. And they thought that the Indians would starve them to death, and anyhow, the Indians fooled them. They took them and done good with them. So after they started improving this ground, they started improving their herds. And now then, the best feeder cattle that these feedlots want to get a hold of and feed are cattle that come from Florida. Now, I've about spoke my piece, and I don't see Sandlow anywhere. And we got Jim Bob Tinsley here. Now, he knows a little bit about this Florida cattle business, and I'm going to let him give you a word or two.
Thank you, Vic. I did talk years ago to a lot of old-time cowmen that are dead now, and discussing some of the things that they were faced with in Florida. A number of things they were faced with that the cowboys out in the West did not have to contend with. Mostly that was insects. Of course, in the cattle business, no matter where you are, you've got, as my grandfather Bryson used to say, you're in the hands of the elements. And you have all of these adversities. I mean, you have the climate and you have the terrain. You have freezes. You have too much water or too little water. All these were suffered by the cowmen in Florida. But one other thing that they had to contend with, that probably no other place in the United States except maybe southern Louisiana, was the insects. And if some of you weren't here yesterday or the day before, when I believe it was Mr. Mills, George Mills, telling about the things that they used to have to, in the old days, have to wrap tow sacks around. Put a tow sack over their horse's head with just room for his nostrils or holes for his nostrils and his ears. Wrap their legs in tow sacks. Wrap their whole carcass in tow sacks to keep the cow flies and the deer flies from eating them literally up, practically. They had these to contend with. Now, the old time, before they had the range law, or the fence laws, the cattlemen had two roundups. They had the spring roundups where they divided up their cows and calves, those that were marked and the calves that were following their mammies. If they didn't, they had to mammy up the calf with the cow.
and they branded them and earmarked them, maybe some dewlap cuts and things, and turned them loose again. Now, they had a fall roundup to catch those smaller calves that they hadn't caught during the spring roundup. They did this on a community-type base or community basis as far as the ranches were concerned. They had the big cow hunts. They weren't necessarily roundups because they had to hunt the cows instead of rounding them up. Wasn't a matter of just seeing them out there on the prairie and going out and rounding them up. They had to go back into the palmetto thickets and the swamps and hunt them. Well, when they got them all out, then they divvied up and separated the ones that belonged to each rancher. They went out and they took with them, it became to be known in the West as a chuck wagon, which was a four-wheel affair, but in Florida it was usually a two-wheel cart where they carried all their grub and everything. They went out and set up a cow camp and then hunted cows for a radius of about 10 miles, rounding them up and putting them in holding pens. Now, even though this was open range, there were holding pens at different areas so that when they did their branding and things, they could put them in these little holding pens, small corrals scattered all over the rangeland to where they could mark them and brand them. Then they would move on to another area. These cowboys, I mentioned yesterday from the old newspaper articles and things, their hats cost them 75 cents or a dollar each. They were wool felt. They weren't fur felt. The more sweat and rain they got on them, the better they became because it waterproofed them. They wore boots that were made in Boston, Massachusetts that came up over their knees, halfway up to their hips because of they needed them for water. The deep water that they might get in, they needed them for bramble bushes and sawbriars and things like this. They at night, they slept. Well, one old timer told me that in South Florida that they used to have to camp for the night and dig around and pile up mud into a pile so that the water would seep out around at the bottom of this pile, and they'd put palm fronds on it and then sleep on that at night. And he said it wasn't unusual for the whole cow camp to be awakened during the night. Out some poor cowboy had turned over and rolled off of the into one of the little ditches that he had dug. You know, that rousted everybody up. They had to deal with wild animals. One animal that they had problems with and also was a benefit to them was the alligator. Sometimes in dry weather, the alligators, where they had wallowed out a hole and fresh water seeped in, that was the only water that the cowboys had to drink for themselves even. And they had to rope the alligator and pull him out of the hole or else his musk would render that water unusable. Is that unusable? They couldn't use it, in other words. Cowboying at that time was somewhat of a seasonal occupation. About the only time they really needed them was to the cow hunts in the spring and cow hunts in the fall. They made about what is equivalent to a dollar a day. And some of the cowboys built up their own herds because, well, Judge Zeb King down in South Florida, he would give away every... Let's see, he gave every fifth calf away to some of his cowboys. And this way, I mean, some of them had, Zeb King, for instance, had anywhere between 30 and 40,000 head of cattle. So every third calf that was born, if he gave to one of his cowhands, it wouldn't take him very long to build up a pretty sizable herd. They were, as we mentioned one time before in some of this, some of the cattle kings also had citrus. Vic's one of them that still believes in that. He's got how many orange trees?
I've got 15 acres of oranges. I've got 8 cows and 1 bull.
All right. See, all cattle kings got into the citrus business too, but it wasn't an unusual thing because if the cow business failed that year, why chances are he'd strike it with citrus. Or if citrus didn't make it, maybe the cattle would. But that far south, it was pretty sure thing, the citrus, but not necessarily the cattle. Nancy, you got anything to say?
Wait just a minute. While they're fresh on, you you mentioned some stuff I want to take up there. When Jim Bob was talking about the cow camps and where they penned the cattle and they'd spend 10 days or so at one cow camp. Well, I don't like to tell nothing unless it's the truth and really happened, and this really happened. Down here at Arcadia on Parker Brothers Ranch, well, Hooker Parker, he was one of the brothers, and when they were out with the wagon, the camp wagon, well, he went along, and he was the boss, and he was the ramrod, and he run this thing. Well, there was some goners lived over there at Arcadia, and one of them had a peg leg. We called him Peg Goner. Well, he couldn't ride a horse so well and everything, but he could run that, he could move that cook wagon and cook. He was the cook for the crew. Well, the day it come time to move, well, he was supposed to move. And, of course, the cowboys, they went on and gathered some cattle and pinned them, and they was waiting there at this place where he was supposed to camp, and it got sundown, and Peg Goner didn't show up. And they got to worrying about him, and Hooker said he'll be here after a while. And he was pulling this chuck wagon. It was a two-wheel cart like Jim Bob was talking about, and he was pulling it with two oxen. And anyhow, about later on in the night, well, Hooker got on his horse, and he said, I'll go hunt him. And he found him right near back to where they was camped at to start with. And Hooker asked Peg, he said, Peg, he said, what in the world happened? And he said, Hooker, he said, did you ever get on the wrong road with the ox wagon? So now go ahead over there.
Well, I want to tell you what the things that have happened to me in being married to Vic and living on a ranch and everything in the early 40s. And when the screw worms came in here was one of the most terrible things that had happened to the cow industry. And it killed off a lot of the calves, and especially the young calves, and they would bush up to where you couldn't find them. But I rode with Vic lots, and one day we rode, and he treated 18 of these calves. He roped them and would treat them, and he'd bring them up. He would set on them, put his legs over them. But let me tell you, that the deal that I got out of that was to keep the old cow off of Vic. And these Brahma cattle, I mean, they were on the hook. And I done some real fast riding that day. And I tell you, I could have lost my plate if I hadn't kept all those cows off of him. Of course, he'd only roast one calf at a time, but those cows really did fight. And it was something to really get out there.
Really?
And it was a lot of work. We left, I think, the house that morning around 7, and it was about 4:30 that afternoon. We hadn't had any lunch or anything before we came back in. And hot, and the horses were tired and everything, but as the eradication come along, that was one of the ticks, of course. Eradicating the ticks was one of the marvelous things that happened to the cow industry. But the screw worms, that when they eliminated those, that was the I thought when the cattle began to improve. And then they improved the grass and everything and the quality of the cattle and everything. But it has really, really, I'm on really yesterday, today, and the 3 days to watch this and be a part of it and see it all improve and everything has been really exciting.
Wow, you're being so excited here. I would like to just ask a few questions to clear up things. I know that for myself, I come from an area of the United States that the cattle industry is not as large as it is here in Florida. And knowing the history of some of the cattle here in Florida, you talk about getting rid of the screw worm and getting rid of the ticks. Could you explain what the screw worm was and how it affected the cattle and how they got rid of that? I think that's a real big important part of the history of Florida ranching.
Vic wants to tell this quickie. I want to tell this little quickie about Vic. The screw worms are a tiny, tiny little worm that gets in the navel, and it'll chew a big hole. They will multiply in there. But he came in one day. I hadn't been riding with him this time, and I had tomato gravy with over rice. And he looked there a little bit, and he said, "Faye, let's don't have any more of this." Now you can tell it. Screw worms.
just tell, you know, I'm just saying from a perspective of not knowing what these things, what was the screwworm? How did it affect the cattle, and how did y'all get rid of that in the cows in Florida?
All right. The screwworm, as far as I know, it's come out of Mexico, come out of old Mexico into Texas. And, of course, I was raised over in Texas, and I was used to them. And we doctored them. We didn't pay too much attention to them. But when they got over here, that's all open country out there, and you can find those cattle that's got screw worms. And they're a screw worm is a it comes from a fly, kind of like a maggot. But instead of living on dead flesh, it lives on live flesh. And all you've got to do is skin a little place where there's a drop of blood, and those flies will lay their eggs, and screw worms will get in the cows. So in 1934 is when they come to Florida, and they come in over around Jacksonville somewhere and went south and come around the state. But they've done some experimenting with them. And, of course, down here in Florida, the calves, every newborn calf would get worms. And he could hide from you. There's so much palmettos and stuff that where he could hide from you, and it was hard to find them and keep them treated. But anyhow, I guess it was the University of Florida experimented with these flies, and they found out that they could sterilize the male flies and do away with the screw worms. And of course, they put all that news out, and we were reluctant to think they could. It was just too big a problem to think that we could get relieved that away. But anyhow, when they got this thing fixed up, they took airplanes, and they would dump these sterile flies out just ready to hatch. And they'd drop them out over all the country. And when they would hatch, they would mate with these. And see, the flies only mate one time. That was why they could do this. So they would drop these sterile male flies out. I don't know how they could tell the difference in the eggs, but anyhow, they dropped the sterile male flies out of these airplanes. And in turn, they would mate with a screwworm fly. And then as they'd die off, there would be no reproduction there. And that's the way they got rid of them.
The state came into Florida, it's already here. But what I'm trying to say is that at Sebring, you can tell them about how they...
Well, Sebring was the headquarters for it where they fixed up these flies to drop out of the airplane. And then for a couple of years, we were on notice that if we found a case of screwworms, we were supposed to turn it in right away, and they would come and saturate that whole country with them sterile flies. And that's the way they got rid of it. Well, those fellows from Texas, they still had them. They'd ask me about them getting rid of the screwworms down here, and I'd tell them it happened. It really happened. But they was like us. They didn't think that it could be done. But they have done a pretty good job in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico, because they've been putting them out on a bumper strip in old Mexico. They haven't went over all of Mexico, but they've been the United States has been taking a bumper strip of old Mexico to keep them out of the United States.
Nancy, you were talking about any of the others, the tick, the cattle tick. It came out of old Mexico also into Texas. And in the old trail driving days, in the highlights of the heyday in the 1880s, the longhorn steers that they were driving to market up in Kansas and Ogallala, Nebraska, and on into the Dakotas for the armies, as well as consumption by the settlers, these longhorns were immune to the tick, but they were taking them into Kansas. And during these storied days of the old trail drives, they passed Texas fever laws. They called it Texas fever in Texas. They called it the Mexican fever, but it's just a cattle fever caused by these ticks. Well, they closed their borders and wouldn't let Texas cattle come into Kansas, and then Nebraska did the same thing. And this is one of the reasons the old trails kept going farther west each time, because these states, their cattle were not immune to this. Now, the old Florida range cow, or the scrub cow here in Florida, it was somewhat immune to these ticks, but there was a big tick infestation of Florida cattle back in the 20s and 30s, and they had to eradicate that with with dipping cattle in an arsenic solution. Just drive them through and where they'd fall into an open vat with this, and then crawl on out the other side. This was eliminated. They had to kill deers in the Everglades. It was just open season for all deer that you saw because they carried this tick. And there was a reinfestation about 20 years ago of this cattle tick that it caused a cattle fever. But the 17th Street in 17th Avenue, no, 17th Street in Ocala was a dividing line. Every cow that was shipped out of Florida or was in Florida had to be taken regularly to the vats and dipped. And they've eliminated it so far. It probably will turn up sometime in the future, however.
Well, Vic, is this why we had to dip the horses when we would take them out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, we've been telling you about all the cattle and everything, and I want to tell you a little bit about my experience in the cattle business or what I have done. We was on this ranch over there, and while we had about 300 head of crossbred Bremer cows, and they were pretty mean. And when the screwworms was here, until they eradicated the screwworms, we didn't have time to do anything else but look after them cows and keep the screwworms out of them. But as soon as the screwworms got eradicated, well, then we put in, we had 12,000 acres, and we sold six of it. We took the money that we got the 6,000 for, and we improved 1,000 acres of this six that we kept. We put that into clover and pangola, put in irrigation, seepage irrigation, and that irrigation worked for drainage in the rainy season. And I bought a herd of purebred Angus cows, and I put Bremer bulls on them, and I got half-breed cows out of there. Well, all of those heifer calves we kept. And in 1974, when we quit and retired and sold out, I had 1,000 head of those half-breed Bremer cows. And I'd put Hereford bulls on those half-breed cows. And I would sell everything, the heifers and all. I didn't keep no replacements out of that third cross. And I kept this herd of purebred Angus with a Bremer bull on them to keep up my replacements for the half-breed herd. And so anyhow, we had this, and when all this started, we was getting about a 50% calf crop, and I brought that calf crop up to 90%, and 1 year I got a 95. And so anyhow, we had 1,000 head of half-breed cows when we sold out. And we were running them on an acre of improved grass and 5 acres of woods land.
In the old days, it took 20 acres to run one cow on unimproved grass or grazing land.
Nancy? I think it's interesting just to hear your life, you know, a day out of your life, your work day or whatever. What types of, maybe you could give us an idea when you first started working cattle, what your day was like as opposed to maybe when you finally gave up and retired. What type of changes? Give us an idea of what it started out like and what it ended up like.
Well, there was lots of changes. Back then, you went to work by sunup, and you worked till you couldn't see. And as things got better and we threw the screwworms and improved everything, you could look after your cattle easier, you could get it done quicker, and we didn't do much work after sundown anymore.
What would a day be like, an average day? What activities would you do in that day?
Oh, my goodness. It's whatever come up, whatever. We had to look after these improved pastures when we were irrigating. We was having to run motors to pump that water and all that. It wasn't all cowboy, and it was just more like farm work or something like that. But every day there would be something to do, and you never got plumb caught up.
Well, it's a seasonal thing. In the spring, in the dry weather, this is when you had the irrigation running, all right? Then the rainy season come along from about June the 15th up until the 15th of September. Then when the dry weather come again, you had this hay field, and we put up how many thousand bales of hay?
Oh, I put up enough hay to feed them cattle in the wintertime. And
it would be from through most of December, January, and February. But one of the things that I think after the screwworms were eradicated was we had the transportation to go the miles. We could load up our horse and these Dunnigan trailers and things like that. At right at the start, all we had was a three-quarter ton truck with no ramp or anything, and you had to back it down into a ditch. It was just easier to ride to where you was going. But when you got the trailer, then you could go lots quicker, get it done, and come on back.
What would you do? You're talking about using the trailer. Explain that process.
Well you'd saddle your horses and load them in a trailer and drive to where you're going to do your work and get out and do your cattle work and load your horses back in the trailer and be back for lunch.
But when you had to ride, good gracious, it would be 15, 20 miles
when
to
you,
the other
when
side.
When you rode, when you went out horseback a riding, you stayed out there till you got your work done and come back in. If it was dark, all right. If it was 4 o'clock or whenever, but you've done all your work before you come back.
Now, he can go without lunch, but I can't. And I finally got to where I'd pack me a candy bar or a sandwich or something along. And we had a couple of colts one time that we were riding, and this was make a little money on the side. And so when the colts got to where they wouldn't buck too hard, well, that was my horse. And this one day I said, let's take a thermos, a jug along, thermos. And he tied it on the front of this saddle, and this old colt bucked for about 45 minutes, but it never did buck him off, but it sure hammered the heck out of that thermos jug. We didn't have no coffee for lunch.
Now, are there anybody out there got any questions they'd like to ask? I can answer them questions better than I can tell stories. They were cattle that come from when Ponce de Leon brought them here to Florida, the first cattle that was brought to the United States.
And they mixed with those mealy-nosed cattle from South North Carolina and Georgia, and it just developed into a scrub cow. I said this morning it may weigh 600 pounds, but Vic said that it had to be an awful good one to weigh 600 pounds.
I never saw it.
And the bulls they'd get to breed these cows with would be, they'd pick out their best bull calves when they were branding and marking and cutting, and they would keep them for bulls for replacements. So there was no way they could improve them.
Not every one of the bulls, though, however. In the old days when they were shipping cattle to Cuba, the rank bulls are the ones that were pretty feisty. They were bought in Cuba for bull fighting. A lot of the prime bulls, if you can say they were prime at that time. But I mentioned this morning, I read a story about a fellow talking about the early Florida scrub cattle. Before we knew what the term 4-H meant, he called them 4-H cattle, hide, horn, hooves, and hair, and nothing else.
I like that.
The feedlots out west is what whole lot helped the crossbred cattle in improving in them down here. Those feedlots out there they found out that's where they raise the grain in the feed to feed those fattening cattle on. You can ship the cattle cheaper to the feed than you can ship the feed to the cattle, if you understand what I'm talking about. And they wanted crossbred cattle to feed out. And they also found out that the crossbred cattle in Florida done better, improved, and gained more weight than any cow anywhere in the United States. So they like these Florida crossbred cattle for the feedlots. And that's a whole lot what brought about the improvement of the beef cattle in Florida.
Any other questions? I'm sure we could probably talk forever. Just before we quit here, you said you've ranched in Texas, and do you notice any differences, or can you tell us any differences between the ranching style in Texas as opposed to the ranching style in Florida?
Well, there's quite a bit of difference. For one thing, the land here has got no mineral in it whatever. And that was a whole lot of why these scrub cattle were little. They weren't... As far as being scrub cattle, it wasn't because they were little. They called them scrubbed because they were little. And because they were little is because they didn't get all the minerals out of the ground that it took for them to to put on weight and be big. Well, out west there, the grass only stays green about 30 days out of the year, but it cures and they strengthen that grass the year round, and you very little feeding you have to do, and it's all open country. You ain't got these swamps and whatnot. They're easy to gather and everything else.
Okay. Any other questions? I see people, the cloggers are starting to gather, and we do have a program at 5 o'clock here. This is the very last workshop that we're doing here on the ranchers here. And I think that we can give them a great hand thank them for all of their work this weekend. We really appreciate your help here, and we've all enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Wasn't, but anyhow, I've always. Calves they would keep for replacement bulls, and they didn't sell no heifers, whatever. They kept all the heifers, and at that time they only had about a 35% calf crop. In other words, they'd have 35 calves out of 100 head of cows. So half of them would be bull calves, so they didn't get to keep too many heifers. And the old cows that would die off, they never sold an old cow, and them old cows would die off, and they had to keep all their heifers. And then they would have quite a time of keeping their numbered herd up. And back when I come down here, well, I got talking to them about improving some of this ground, and they made fun of me. Because the only way they knew how to clear the palmettos off was with a grubbing hoe, and you ain't going to get a cowboy to work with a grubbing hoe. So I quit talking about improving the pastures. But after several years, after about 1940, then the University of Florida got to telling them that they should do all this. And some of the county agents in each county over the state would get them to clear up a little piece, and they would dolomite it, put lime and dolomite on it, and got them started that way. And then they had to buy up this land to have any. At that time, the state owned all the land. It didn't cost them nothing to run their cattle on it. But after they bought this land and had to pay taxes on it, it cost them more to run their cattle. They had to improve and try to do better. So that's when things started changing. And I was waiting on Sandlode John's down here. I'm gonna get him to give you some information on it, because I think that's off of the Indian reservation, and I think they have done better on commercial cattle. Maybe not in the late years, but they're the ones that started. They had the first purebred herd of cattle in Florida. The rest of them was all crossbreds and come from them DeSoto cattle or Ponce de Leon cattle. But the government sent a train load or two of purebred, they weren't registered, but they were purebred white-faced cattle down here for the Indians. And they thought that the Indians would starve them to death, and anyhow, the Indians fooled them. They took them and done good with them. So after they started improving this ground, they started improving their herds. And now then, the best feeder cattle that these feedlots want to get a hold of and feed are cattle that come from Florida. Now, I've about spoke my piece, and I don't see Sandlow anywhere. And we got Jim Bob Tinsley here. Now, he knows a little bit about this Florida cattle business, and I'm going to let him give you a word or two.
I did talk years ago to a lot of old-time cowmen that are dead now, and discussing some of the things that they were faced with in Florida, a number of things they were faced with that the cowboys out in the West did not have to contend with. Mostly that was insects. Of course, in the cattle business, no matter where you are, you've got, as my grandfather Bryson used to say, you're in the hands of the elements. And you have all of these adversities. I mean, you have the climate and you have the terrain. You have freezes. You have too much water or too little water. All these were suffered by the cowmen in Florida. And what? But one other thing that they had to contend with that probably no other place in the United States except maybe southern Louisiana was the insects. And if some of you weren't here yesterday or the day before when I believe it was Mr. Mills, George Mills, telling about the things that they used to have to, in the old days, have to wrap tow sacks around, put a tow sack over their horse's head with just room for his nostrils or to holes for his nostrils and his ears, wrap their legs in tow sacks, wrap their whole carcass in tow sacks to keep keep the cow flies and the deer flies from eating them literally up practically. They had these to contend with. Now, the old time, when before they had the range law, or the fence laws, the cattlemen had two roundups. They had the spring roundups where they divided up their cows and calves, those that were marked and the calves that were following their mammies. If they didn't, they had to mammy up the calf with the cow. And they branded them and earmarked them, maybe some dewlap cuts and things, and turned them loose again. Now, they had a fall roundup to catch those smaller calves that they hadn't caught during the spring roundup. They did this on a community-type base or community basis as far as the ranches were concerned. They had the big cow hunts. They weren't necessarily roundups because they had to hunt the cows instead of rounding them up. Wasn't a matter of just seeing them out there on the prairie and going out and rounding them up. They had to go back into the palmetto thickets and the swamps and hunt them. Well, when they got them all out, then they divvied up and separated the ones that belonged to each rancher. They went out and they took with them, it became to be known in the West as a chuck wagon, which was a four-wheel affair, but in Florida it was usually a two-wheel cart where they carried all their grub and everything. They went out and set up a cow camp and then hunted cows for a radius of about 10 miles, rounding them up and putting them in holding pens. Now, even though this was open range, there were holding pens at different areas so that when they did their branding and things, they could put them in these little holding pens, small corrals scattered all over the rangeland to where they could mark them and brand them. Then they would move on to another area. These cowboys, I mentioned yesterday from the old newspaper articles and things, their hats cost them 75 cents or a dollar each. They were wool felt. They weren't fur felt. The more sweat and rain they got on them, the better they became because it waterproofed them. They wore boots that were made in Boston, Massachusetts, that came up over their knees, halfway up to their hips, because of they needed them for water, the deep water that they might get in. They needed them for bramble bushes and sawbriars and things like this. They at night. They slept, one old timer told me that in South Florida that they used to have to camp for the night and dig around and pile up mud into a pile so that the water would seep out around at the bottom of this pile, and they'd put palm fronds on it and then sleep on that at night. And he said it wasn't unusual for the whole cow camp to be awakened during the night. Some poor cowboy had turned over and rolled off of the into one of the little ditches that he had dug, you know, that rousted everybody up. They had to deal with wild animals. One animal that they had problems with, and also was a benefit to them, was the alligator. Sometimes in dry weather, the alligators, where they had wallowed out a hole and fresh water seeped in, as the only water that the cowboys had to drink for themselves, even. And they had to rope the alligator and pull him out of the hole, or else his musk would render that water unusable. Is that yes. They couldn't use it, in other words. Cowboying at that time was somewhat of a seasonal occupation. About the only time they really needed them was to the cow hunts in the spring and cow hunts in the fall. They made about what is equivalent to a dollar a day. And some of the cowboys built up their own herds because, Judge Zibe King down in South Florida, he would give away every, let's see, he gave every fifth cow,
calf
away to some of his cowboys. And this way, I mean, some of them had, Zab King, for instance, had anywhere between 30 and 40,000 head of cattle. So every third calf that was born, if he gave to one of his cowhands, it wouldn't take him very long to build up a pretty sizable herd. They were, as we mentioned one time before in some of this, some of the cattle kings also had citrus. Vic's one of them that still believes in that. He's got how many orange trees?
I've got 15 acres of oranges. I've got 8 cows and 1 bull.
All right. See, all cattle kings got into the citrus business too, but it wasn't an unusual thing because if the cow business failed that year, why... chances are he'd strike it with citrus, or if citrus didn't make it, maybe the cattle would. But that far south, it was pretty sure thing, the citrus, but not necessarily the cattle. Nancy, you got anything to say?
Wait just a minute. While they're fresh on, you mentioned some stuff I want to take up there. When Jim Bob was talking about the cow camps and where they penned the cattle, and they'd spend 10 days or so at one cow camp. Well, I don't like to tell nothing unless it's the truth and really happened, and this really happened. Down here at Arcadia on Parker Brothers Ranch, well, Hooker Parker, he was one of the brothers, and when they were out with the wagon, the camp wagon, well, he went along, and he was the boss, and he was the ramrod, and he run this thing. Well, there was some goners lived over there at Arcadia, and one of them had a peg leg. We called him Peg Goner. Well, he couldn't ride a horse so well and everything, but he could run that, he could move that cook wagon and cook. He was the cook for the crew. Well, the day it come time to move, well, he was supposed to move. And, of course, the cowboys, they went on and gathered some cattle and pinned them, and they was waiting there at this place where he was supposed to camp, and it got sundown, and Peg Goner didn't show up. And they got to worrying about him, and Hooker said he'll be here after a while. And he was pulling this chuck wagon. It was a two-wheel cart like Jim Bob was talking about, and he was pulling it with two oxens. And anyhow, about later on in the night, well, Hooker got on his horse, and he said, I'll go hunt him. And he found him right there back to where they was camped at to start with. And Hooker asked Peg, he said, Peg, he said, what in the world happened? And he said, Hooker, he said, did you ever get on the wrong road with the ox wagon? So now go ahead over there.
Well, I want to tell you what the things that have happened to me in being married to Vic and living on a ranch and everything in the early 40s. And when the screwworms came in here was one of the most terrible things that had happened to the cow industry. And it killed off a lot of the calves, and especially the young calves, and they would bush up to where you couldn't find them. But I rode with Vic lots, and one day we rode, and he treated 18 of these calves. He roped them and would treat them, and he'd bring them up. He would sit on them, put his legs over them. But let me tell you, that the deal that I got out of that was to keep the old cow off of Vic. And these Brahma cattle, I mean, they were on the hook, and I done some real fast riding that day. And I tell you, I could have lost my plate if I hadn't kept all those cows off of him. Of course, he'd only roast one calf at a time, but those cows really did fight. And it was something to really get out there.
Really?
And it was a lot of work. We left, I think, the house that morning around 7, and it was about 4:30 that afternoon. We hadn't had any lunch or anything before we came back in. But and hot, and the horses were tired and everything. But as the eradication come along, that was one of the ticks, of course. Eradicating the ticks was one of the marvelous things that happened to the cow industry. But the screwworms, that when they eliminated those, that was the really the I thought when the cattle began to improve, and then they improved the grass and everything and the quality of the cattle and everything. But it has really, really, I'm on really yesterday, today, and the 3 days to watch this and be a part of it and see it all improve and everything. It's been really exciting.
While you're being so excited here, I would like to just ask a few questions to clear up things. I know that for myself, I come from an area of the United States that the cattle industry is not as large as it is here in Florida. And knowing the history of some of the cattle here in Florida, you talk about getting rid of the screw worm and getting rid of the ticks. Could you explain what the screw worm was and how it affected the cattle and how they got rid of that? I think that's a real big important part of the history of Florida ranching.
Vic wants to tell this quickie. I want to tell this little quickie about Vic. The screw worms are a tiny, tiny little worm that gets in the navel, and it'll chew a big hole. They will multiply in there. But he came in one day. I hadn't been riding with him this time, and I had tomato gravy with over rice, and he looked there a little bit, and he said, "Faye, let's don't have any more of this." Now you can tell it. About the screw worms.
I'm just saying from a perspective of not knowing what these things, what was a screw worm? How did it affect the cattle, and how did y'all get rid of that in the cows in Florida?
All right. The screw worm, as far as I know, it come out of old Mexico into Texas. And, of course, I was raised over in Texas, and I was used to them. And we doctored them. We didn't pay too much attention to them. But when they got over here, that's all open country out there, and you can find those cattle that's got screw worms, and they're a screw worm is a it comes from a fly like a maggot, but instead of living on dead flesh, it lives on live flesh, and all you've got to do is skin a little place where there's a drop of blood, and those flies will lay their eggs, and screw worms will get in the cows. So in 1934 is when they come to Florida, and they come in over around Jacksonville somewhere and went south and come around the state. But they've done some experimenting with them. And, of course, down here in Florida, the calves, every newborn calf would get worms. And he could hide from you. There's so much palmettos and stuff that where he could hide from you, and it was hard to find them and keep them treated. But anyhow, University of Florida experimented with these flies, and they found out that they could sterilize the male flies and do away with the screw worms. And of course, they put all that news out, and we were reluctant to think they could. It was just too big a problem to think that we could get relieved that way. But anyhow, when they got this thing fixed up, they took airplanes and they would dump these sterile flies out just ready to hatch, and they'd drop them out over all the country, and when they would hatch, they would mate with these, and see, the flies only mate one time. That was why they could do this. So they would drop these sterile male flies out. I don't know how they could tell the difference in the eggs, but anyhow, they dropped the sterile male flies out of these airplanes, and in turn they would mate with a screw worm fly, and then as they'd die off, there would be no reproduction there, and that's the way they got rid of them.
The state came into Florida, it's already here, but what I'm trying to say is that at Sebring, you can tell them about how they...
Well, Sebring was the headquarters for it where they fixed up these flies to drop out of the airplane, and then for a couple of years, we were on notice that if we found a case of screw worms, we were supposed to turn it in right away, and they would come and saturate that whole country with them sterile flies. And that's the way they got rid of it. Well, those fellows from Texas, they still had them. They'd ask me about them getting rid of the screw worms down here, and I'd tell them it happened. It really happened. But they was like us. They didn't think that it could be done. But they have done a pretty good job in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico, because they've been putting them out on a bumper strip in old Mexico. They haven't went over all of Mexico, but they've been the United States has been taking a bumper strip of old Mexico to keep them out of the United States.
Nancy, you were talking about any of the others, the tick, the cattle tick, it came out of old Mexico also into Texas, And in the old trail driving days, in the 18 the highlights of the heyday in the 1880s, the Longhorn steers that they were driving to market up in Kansas and Ogallala, Nebraska, and on into the Dakotas for the armies, as well as consumption by the settlers. These Longhorns were immune to the tick, but they were taking them into Kansas. And during these storied days of the old trail drives, they passed Texas fever laws. They called it Texas fever. In Texas, they called it the Mexican fever, but it's just a cattle fever caused by these ticks. Well, they closed their borders and wouldn't let Texas cattle come into Kansas, and then Nebraska did the same thing. And this is one of the reasons the old trails kept going farther west each time, because these states, their cattle were not immune to this. Now, the old Florida range cow, or the scrub cow here in Florida, it was somewhat immune to these ticks, but there was a big tick infestation of Florida cattle back in the 20s and 30s, and they had to eradicate that with dipping cattle in an arsenic solution. Just drive them through and where they'd fall into an open vat with this, and then crawl on out the other side. This was eliminated. They had to kill deers in the Everglades. It was just open season for all deer that you saw, because they carried this tick. And there was a reinfestation about 20 years ago of this cattle tick that it caused a cattle fever. But the 17th Street in 17th Avenue, no, 17th Street in Ocala was a dividing line. Every cow that was shipped out of Florida or was in Florida had to be taken regularly to the vats and dipped, and they've eliminated it so far. It probably will turn up sometime in the future, however.
Well, Vic, is this why we had to dip the horses when we would take them out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Now, we've been telling you about all the cattle and everything, and I want to tell you a little bit about my experience in the cattle business, or what I have done. We was on this ranch over there, and while we had about 300 head of crossbred Bremer cows, and they were pretty mean. And when the screwworms was here, until they eradicated the screwworms, we didn't have time to do anything else but look after them cows and keep the screwworms out of them. But as soon as the screwworms got eradicated, well, then we put in, we had 12,000 acres, and we sold six of it. We took the money that we got the 6,000 for, and we improved 1,000 acres of this six that we kept. We put that into clover and pangola, put in irrigation, seepage irrigation, and that irrigation worked for drainage in the rainy season. And I bought a herd of purebred Angus cows, and I put Bremer bulls on them, and I got half-breed cows out of there. Well, all of those heifer calves we kept. And in 1974, when we quit and retired and sold out, I had 1,000 head of those half-breed Bremer cows. And I'd put Hereford bulls on those half-breed cows. And I would sell everything, the heifers and all. I didn't keep no replacements out of that third cross. And I kept this herd of purebred Angus with a Bremer bull on them to keep up my replacements for the half-breed herd. And so anyhow, we had this, and when all this started, we was getting about a 50% calf crop, and I brought that calf crop up to 90%, and one year I got a 95. And so anyhow, we had 1,000 head of half-breed cows when we sold out. And we were running them on an acre of improved grass and 5 acres of woodland.
In the old days, it took 20 acres to run one cow of unimproved grass or grazing land.
Nancy? I think it's interesting just to hear your life, you know, a day out of your life, your work day or whatever. What types of, maybe you could give us an idea when you first started working cattle, what your day was like, as opposed to maybe when you finally gave up and retired, what type of changes? Give us an idea of what it started out like and what it ended up like.
Well, there was lots of changes. Back then, you went to work by sun up, and you worked till you couldn't see. And as things got better and we're through the screw worms and improved everything, you could look after your cattle easier, you could get it done quicker, and we didn't do much work after sundown anymore.
What would a day be like, an average day? What activities would you do in that day?
Oh, my goodness. It's whatever come up, whatever. We had to look after these improved pastures when we were irrigating. We was having to run motors to pump that water and all that. It wasn't all cowboy, and it was just more like farm work or something like that. But every day there would be something to do, and you never got plumb caught up.
Well, it's a seasonal thing. In the spring, in the dry weather, this is when you had the irrigation running, all right? Then the rainy season come along from about June the 15th up until the 15th of September. Then when the dry weather come again, you had this hay field, and we put up how many thousand bales of hay?
Oh, I put up enough hay to feed them cattle in the wintertime.
It would be from... through most of December, January, and February. But one of the things that I think after the screw worms were eradicated was we had the transportation to go the miles. We could load up our horse and these Dunnigan trailers and things like that. Right at the start, all we had was a three-quarter ton truck with no ramp or anything, and you had to back it down into a ditch. It was just easier to ride to where you was going. But when you got the trailer, then you could go lots quicker, get it done, and come on back.
What would you do? You're talking about using the trailer. Explain that process.
You'd saddle your horses and load them in a trailer and drive to where you're going to do your work and get out and do your cattle work and load your horses back in the trailer and be back for lunch.
But when you had to ride, good gracious, it would be 15, 20 miles
when
to
you,
the other
when
side.
When you rode, when you went out horseback a riding, you stayed out there till you got your work done and come back in. If it was dark, all right. If it was 4 o'clock or whenever, but you've done all your work before you come back.
Now, he can go without lunch, but I can't. And I finally got to where I'd pack me a candy bar or a sandwich or something along. And we had a couple of colts one time that we were riding, and this was make a little money on the side. And so when the colts got to where they wouldn't buck too hard, well, that was my horse. And this one day I said, let's take a thermos jug along. And he tied it on the front of this saddle, and this old colt bucked for about 45 minutes, but it never did buck him off, but it sure hammered the heck out of that thermos jug. We didn't have no coffee for lunch.
Now, are there anybody out there got any questions they'd like to ask? I can answer them questions better than I can tell stories. They were cattle that come from when Ponce de Leon brought them here to Florida, the first cattle that was brought to the United States.
And they mixed with those mealy-nosed cattle from South North Carolina and Georgia, and it just developed into a scrub cow. I said this morning it may weigh 600 pounds, but Vic said that it had to be an awful good one to weigh 600 pounds.
And the bulls they'd get to breed these cows with would be, they'd pick out their best bull calves when they were branding and marking and cutting, and they would keep them for bulls for replacements. So there was no way they could improve them.
Not every one of the bulls, though, however. In the old days when they were shipping cattle to Cuba, the rank bulls or the ones that were pretty feisty, they were bought in Cuba for bull fighting. A lot of the prime bulls, if you can say they were prime at that time. But I mentioned this morning, I read a story about a fella talking about the early Florida scrub cattle. Before we knew what the term 4-H meant, he called them 4-H cattle, hide, horn, hooves, and hair, and nothing else.
I like that.
The feedlots out west is what whole lot helped the crossbred cattle and improving in them down here. Those feedlots out there they found out that that's where they raise the grain in the feed to feed those fattening cattle on. You can ship the cattle cheaper to the feed than you can ship the feed to the cattle, if you understand what I'm talking about. And they wanted crossbred cattle to feed out. And they also found out that the crossbred cattle in Florida done better, improved, and gained more weight than any cow anywhere in the United States. So they like these Florida crossbred cattle for feedlots. And that's a whole lot what brought about the improvement of the beef cattle in Florida.
Any other questions? I'm sure we could probably talk forever. Just before we quit here, you said you've ranched in Texas, and do you notice any differences, or can you tell us any differences between the ranching style in Texas as opposed to the ranching style in Florida?
Well, there's quite a bit of difference. For one thing, the land here has got no mineral in it whatever. And that was a whole lot of why these scrub cattle were little. They weren't, as far as being scrub cattle, it wasn't because they were little. They called them scrubbed because they were little. And because they were little is because they didn't get all the minerals out of the ground that it took for them to put on weight and be big. Well, out west there, the grass only stays green about 30 days out of the year, but it cures and they strengthen that grass the year round, and you very little feeding you have to do, and it's all open country. You ain't got these swamps and whatnot. They're easy to gather and everything else.
Okay, any other questions? I see people, the cloggers are starting to gather, and we do have a program at 5:00 here. This is the very last workshop that we're doing here on the ranchers here, and I think that we can give them a great hand and thank them for all of their work this weekend. We really appreciate your help here, and we've all enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
Wasn't, but anyhow, I've always